Chapter 32. Ira Hagen threw Hudson and Erickson a curve and bypassed Houston. There was no need for the trip. The computer on board his jet told him all he needed to know. A trace of the Texas phone number in General Fisher's black book led to the office of the director of NASA's flight operations, Irwin Mitchell, alias Irwin Dupuy. A check of another name on the list, Steve Larson, turned up Steve Bush, who was director of NASA's Flight Research Center in California. 9 little Indians, and then there were 4. Hagen's tally of the inner core now read, Raymond LeBaron, last reported in Cuba. General Mark Fisher, Colorado Springs. Clyde Booth, Albuquerque. Irwin Mitchell, Houston. Steve Bush, California. Dean Beagle, Philadelphia. ID and location not proven. Daniel Klein, Washington, D.C. Ditto. Leonard Hudson, Maryland. Location not proven. Gunnar Erickson, Maryland. Ditto. His deadline was only 66 hours away. He had kept the president advised of his progress and warned him that his investigation would be cutting it thin. Already the president was putting together a trusted team to gather up members of the inner core and transport them to a location the president had yet to specify. Hagen's ace card was the proximity of the last 3 names on the list. He was gambling they were all sitting in the same basket. Hagen altered his routine and did not waste time renting a car when his plane landed at Philadelphia International Airport. His pilot had called ahead, and a Lincoln limousine was waiting when he stepped down the stairway. During the 24-mile drive along the Schuylkill River to Valley Forge State Park, he worked on his report to the president and formulated a plan to speed the discovery of Hudson and Erickson, whose joint phone number turned out to be a disconnected number in an empty house near Washington. He closed his briefcase as the car rolled past the park where George Washington's army had camped during the winter of 1777-78. Many of the trees still bore golden leaves, and the rolling hills had yet to turn brown. The driver turned onto a road that wound around a hill overlooking the park and was bordered on both sides by old stone walls. The historic Horse and Artillery Inn was built in 1790 as a stagecoach stop and tavern for colonial travelers and sat amid sweeping lawns and a grove of shade trees. It was a picturesque 3-story building with blue shutters and a stately front porch. The inn was an original example of early limestone farm architecture and bore a plaque designating it as listed on the National Register of Historic Places. Hagen left the limousine, climbed the steps to the porch furnished with old-fashioned rockers, and passed into a lobby filled with antique furniture clustered around a cozy fireplace containing a crackling log. In the dining room, he was shown to a table by a girl dressed in colonial costume. "Is Dean around?" he asked casually. "Yes, sir," answered the girl brightly. "The senator is in the kitchen. Would you like to see him?" "I'd be grateful if he could spare me a few minutes." "Would you like to see a menu in the meantime?" "Yes, please." Hagen scanned the menu and found the list of early American dishes to be quite tempting. But his mind didn't really dwell on food. Was it possible, he thought, that Dean Beagle was Senator Dean Porter, who once chaired the powerful Foreign Relations Committee and narrowly lost a presidential primary race to George McGovern? A member of the Senate for nearly 30 years, Porter had left an indelible mark on American politics before he had retired 2 years ago. A bald-headed man in his late 70s walked through a swinging door from the kitchen, wiping his hands on the lower edge of an apron. An unimpressive figure with a grandfatherly face. He stopped at Hagen's table and looked down without expression. "You wish to see me?" Hagen came to his feet. "Senator Porter." "Yes." "My name is Ira Hagen. I'm a restaurateur myself, specializing in American dishes, but not nearly as creative as your recipes." "Leo told me you might walk through my door," Porter said bluntly. "Won't you please sit down?" "You staying for dinner, Mr. Hagen?" Well, that was my plan. Then permit me to offer you a bottle of local wine on the house. Thank you. Porter called over his waitress and gave the order. Then he turned back to Hagen and looked him solidly in the eye. How many of us have you tagged?
You make six, Hagen answered.
You're lucky you didn't go to Houston. Leo had a reception committee waiting for you. Were you a member of the Inner Corps from the beginning, Senator?
I came on board in 1964 and helped set up the undercover financing.
I compliment you on a first-rate job.
You're working for the President, I take it.
Correct. What does he intend to do with us?
Eventually hand out the honors you all so richly deserve. But his main concern is stopping your people on the moon from starting a war.
Porter paused when the waitress brought over a bottle of chilled white wine. He expertly pulled the cork and poured one glass. He took a large sip and swished the wine around in his mouth and nodded.
Quite good.
Then he filled Hagen's glass.
15 years ago, Mr. Hagen, our government made a stupid mistake and gave away our space technology in a sucker play that was heralded as a handshake in space. If you remember, it was a much-publicized joint venture between American and Russian space programs that called for our Apollo astronauts to team up and meet with the Soyuz cosmonauts in orbit. I was against it from the beginning, but the event occurred during the détente years, and my voice was only a cry in the wilderness. I didn't trust the Russians then, and I don't trust them now. Their whole space program was built on political propaganda and damned little technical achievement. We exposed the Russians to American technology that was 20 years ahead of theirs. After all this time, Soviet space hardware is still crap next to anything we've created. We blew $400 million on a scientific giveaway. The fact we kissed the Russians' asses while they reamed ours only proves Barnum's moral about one born every minute. I made up my mind to never let it happen again. That's why I won't stand dumb and let the Russians steal the fruits of the Jersey colony. If they were technically superior to us, there is no doubt in my mind they would bar us from the moon.
So you agree with Leo that the first Russians to land on the moon must be eliminated?
They'll do everything in their power to grab every scientific windfall from our moon base they can touch.
Face reality, Mr. Hagen. You don't see our secret agents buying Russian high technology and smuggling it to the West. The Soviets have to rely on our progress because they're too stupid and nearsighted to create it on their own.
You don't have a very high regard for the Russians, said Hagen. When the Kremlin decides to build a better world rather than divide and dictate to it, I might change my mind.
Will you help me find Leo?
No, the senator said simply.
The least the Inner Corps can do is listen while the President pleads his case.
Is that why he sent you?
He hoped I could find all of you while there is still time.
Time for what?
In less than 4 days, the first Soviet cosmonauts land on the moon. If your Jersey colony people murder them, their government might feel justified in shooting down a space shuttle or the space lab.
The senator looked at Hagen, his eyes turning to ice.
An interesting conjecture. I guess we'll just have to wait and see, won't we?